From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we'd like to introduce you to a captivating voice not well known outside of New York performance circles. Sekou Sundiata is a poet who collaborates with jazz musicians on theater pieces. His new production, The Mystery of Love, is making its world premiere at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. Also today, one of Latin America's most prominent novelists tells us about his failed bid for the presidency of Peru. We talk with Mario Vargas Llosa. His new memoir, A Fish in the Water, is about his literary and political life. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Boz Scaggs' latest release. It's his first in 6 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. South African President Nelson Mandela has selected members for his cabinet. He's chosen rival and Inkatha leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi as the new Home Affairs Minister. Mandela has also chosen his estranged wife, Winnie, as Deputy Minister for Arts, Culture, Science, and Technology. The cabinet has been sworn in at the Presidential Union Buildings in Pretoria. The White House is denying a Los Angeles Times report that says the United States will send troops to Haiti. The paper reported 600 American troops would attempt to purge the Haitian military. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
Quoting unidentified U.S. officials in Washington and Haiti, the Los Angeles newspaper said the U.S. troops would be sent to Haiti, whether or not tougher international sanctions force Haiti's military rulers from power. A source is quoted as saying, the U.S. would rather see the military leaders step down before sending in troops, but the troops will go in no matter what. Asked about the report this morning, White House Press Secretary Dede Meyers said, the story is wrong. Meyer said the United States still plans to take part in a UN military and police advisory group that would go to Haiti once democracy is restored, but that no plans are underway for an invasion force. A spokeswoman for the Pentagon is denying the Times report as well. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The United Nations says 3 people were killed and 13 were wounded when a Serbian-held town in northeastern Bosnia was shelled. It's feared the town, which lies on a strategic Serbian corridor, could be the next flashpoint in the Bosnian war. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
A UN spokesman said a pregnant woman and 2 children were killed when about 10 mortar rounds hit the Serb-held town of Brčko. There's no confirmation, but he said the Muslim-led Bosnian army was believed to be responsible for the shelling. The attack coincided with the start of a session of the so-called Bosnian Serb parliament in the town. Brčko lies at the thinnest point of a strategic corridor of land which links Serb-held territories. It's vulnerable to Croat and Bosnian forces on either side. More than 30 UN observers were deployed there at the weekend in the hope of averting heavy fighting. The town had a big pre-war majority population of Muslims and Croats, most of whom were either murdered or expelled at the start of the war. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The state of California has cut back its water deliveries to farmers along the Sacramento and San Joaquin rivers. The state says the past winter has been too dry. California's Central Valley Project, which channels melting snow from the Sierra Nevada to farms, is cutting back supplies by 25%. Growers who hold special water rights won't get as much. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 27 points at 3,629. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Germany's central bank has cut 2 key interest rates by 0.5 percentage point. The move is likely to help the U.S. dollar and stimulate German business activity. Germany is a leading economic force in Europe. The Bundesbank has been under growing pressure from other countries to lower rates and help spur an economic recovery across the continent. The Bundesbank has lowered its discount rate from 5% to 4.5%. It's also lowered the Lombard rate, the interest on emergency loans to bank, from 6.5% to 6%. The UN says rebel troops are advancing on Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, and the city could fall within days. The UN Security Council will meet today to discuss proposals to increase the size of the UN force in Rwanda. The rebels' military commander is welcoming the troops, but only if their mission is humanitarian. Mark Doyle reports from Kigali.
Major General Kagame said any increased UN presence should restrict itself to assisting the delivery of humanitarian aid and should not act as an intervention force. The rebels said they launched their offensive to stop the massacre of political and ethnic opponents of the late president, whose death sparked the latest hostilities. Major General Kagame said the UN presence did not need to be larger than 2,500 men, since his force had already done much of the necessary work. The rebel leader meant by this that his men had cleared much of the countryside of the government militia who committed the massacres. The position of the government side on an increased UN military presence is not clear. Because of insecurity, the current UN force of 400 troops is unable to deliver the amount of humanitarian assistance Rwanda requires as a result of the massacres and the war.
The BBC's Mark Doyle. Palestinians are still celebrating the arrival of Palestinian police officers in Gaza. Israeli forces are turning over control of the occupied land to Palestinian officers. I'm Korva Colvin, National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hesitate to call Sekou Sundiata a performance poet, just in case that brings to mind a lot of clichés. Sundiata's work is anything but clichéd. But he is part of a group of poets who are gaining a new following by presenting their words through exciting performances. Writing in The Village Voice, Greg Tate called Sundiata our fiercest poet on the subject of love in struggle. Sundiata's new theater piece, The Mystery of Love, is his second collaboration with jazz trombonist Craig Harris. It opens Friday night at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. Sundiata is the librettist and narrator. The story is about a triangle between three members of a band. Here's an excerpt.
They say there is a line between above and below.
They say there is a line between above and below.
A mystical border.
Between the visible and the invisible.
Between you and
a mystical border between you and the gods.
Somebody much wiser.
And the passage from one world to the next. It's quicker, faster than a change of mind. Somebody, somebody much wiser, somebody much wiser than you or I once said that the truth will not be told by the battles you win or lose, but by the stories we believe in. Whoever said there was a light at the end of the tunnel was a lie. The darkness begins, the blackness takes us back. In between are the stories, the light and the precious lies. I got a story, you got a story. My man Max, my man Shine, and my girl Sissy got a hell of a story. This is the house, this is the house and the home of hearsay, the poetic truth of all the available facts, otherwise known as the crossroads, from sea to can't see. From talk to song, from drum to tongue. The events here described take place in the wilderness of North America. And the names have not been changed to protect nobody. Whatever happens.
Sekou Sundiata is on the faculty of the New School for Social Research. He won a 1992 Bessie Award and was selected as a 1993 Sundance Institute Fellow to write a screenplay adaptation of his previous theater piece. I asked him what music does for him when he's performing his poetry.
It's the way I conceptualize my poetry from the very beginning, you know, in a very musical way. The roots for me of my of poetry comes from my first experience with language, which is through African-American culture. I mean, I fell in love with language through daily speech, you know, the language I heard around me, the way it was used to include and exclude, the way it embraced, the way it chastised, the way, you know, the humor in it, all of that, you know. And the oral tradition as I encountered it at home, but also in the church. You know, we used to go to the Baptist church. And I like to go to church for the ritual, I mean, for the theater of it, you know. I was really captivated. I used to imitate the preachers, you know.
Where did you grow up? What neighborhood did you grow up in? What city?
I grew up in New York City. Spent a great deal of time in my family homeland in South Carolina. But I grew up in Harlem and East Harlem, or El Barrio.
One of the things, obviously, that got to you about language was not only the preachers, but probably the way people insulted each other on the street, right? Which is a really wonderful use of language. Were you good at that? I mean, could you get by with language when you need? Could you protect yourself with language when you needed to?
Well, I
and did people look up to you because of your gift for language?
Well, I don't know about looking up. I do know that I very early on, I could speak. You know, I knew I could express myself. Even before I really developed an interest in writing myself, I loved to read, you know. But I knew I could talk, you know, and I also knew that I was a listener, you know, and even before being a talker, I'm a listener. All of those things, I think, are early influences on developing as a poet.
I'd like to ask you to do one of your poems for us.
Okay. I preface this by saying that this is a poem that I wrote really being influenced by some of my students several years ago who were really into hip-hop and rap music, et cetera, and were interested in writing poetry with that influence going on. So this is sort of a tribute to them, and it's called Blink Your Eyes. What is the mathematics? What is the mathematics of today? What can I say? I was on my way to see my woman, but the law said I was on my way through a red light, red light, red light, red light. It wasn't about no woman, it was about my ride. And if you saw my ride, you could dig that too, you dig? Sunroof, stereo, radio, radio, sunroof, stereo, radio, black leather bucket seats sit low. You know the body's cool, but the tires are worn. Ride when the hard times come, ride when they're gone. In other words, the light was green. I could wake up in the morning without a warning and my world could change. Blink your eyes. All depends on the skin. All depends on the skin you're living in. Up to the window come the law with his hand on his gun. What's up? What's happening? I said, I guess that's when I really broke the law. He said a routine, step out the car. A routine, assume the position. Put your hands up in the air. You know the routine like you just don't care. License and registration. Deep was the night in the light, and deep and deep was the night in the light from the North Star on the car door. I could see deja vu. We've been through this before. Why did you stop me? Somebody, body, 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 body had to stop you. I watch the news. You always lose. This is serious. You could be dangerous. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change. Blink your eyes. All depends on the skin. All depends on the skin you're living in. All depends on the skin. All depends on the skin you're living in. That's an excerpt.
That's great. I really like your writing and the way you recite. Should we use the word recite? That sounds
well. You know, the word we came up with was oralize.
Oralize.
Yeah.
No. Where do you do your poems? What kinds of settings?
Weddings and clubs. Concert halls, unions, you know, labor gatherings, et cetera, and funerals, family reunions.
The poem you just did, was that based on a personal experience?
Many personal experiences. I mean, and it's interesting, when I said that part of the idea of the poem being a tribute to some of my students who were interested in hip-hop was because of the hip-hop influence, but also because of the experience that black males, and particularly young black males, have with the police. So this idea of being stopped by the police, constantly questioned by the police, unwarranted interrogation by the police, et cetera, yeah, that's a personal experience that I've had, but one that's widely shared in the black community.
In those times when you've been stopped by a cop,
mm-hmm.
have you tried to use language to explain yourself or, you know, to just help, like, get his respect, the cop's respect?
Yeah, but, you know, at that point, language sort of breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm speaking the language of the innocent, you know, but I've already been judged guilty, you know. So there's a breakdown there. And it's no longer about language. It's about power.
In Mystery of Love, you say the truth cannot be told by the battles you win or lose, but by the stories we believe in.
Hmm.
You believe that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the battles tell one aspect of the truth. You know, maybe in a more factual kind of way. But I think once we understand what kinds of belief systems and values people carry around, you know, we get to a more central kind of truth.
So were there certain stories you grew up on, like either family stories or stories about the neighborhood or?
Yeah, I mean, stories I grew up on, but as you say that right now, there's another story that I'm much more interested in that I'd really like to tell you.
Yeah, please.
My family just started having family reunions in the last 4 or 5 years, and both sides of my family are based in South Carolina. And so I went to a family reunion in Charleston, South Carolina. My mother, who lives there, lives about 70 miles inland from Charleston. So this was the day of the family banquet. So we were all gathered, you know, and the food was there, et cetera. And I was asked to speak and to do a poem at the family reunion, you know. And I was supposed to talk about the importance of family. That was my assignment, you know. And so, I went to pick my mother up, and we're all in the car, my mother, her sister, a couple of kids, and we're driving back to Charleston for the banquet. And we just happened to be riding in two-lane highway. And my mother and her sister kind of joking, talking about the family, and said, well, you know, you never know who's related to who, because from here right out to the coast, out to Charleston, were all these plantations. And they often sold, you know, slaves from one plantation to the other. So, and kind of laughing and saying, you know, we might have cousins stretching from here straight out to, you know, out to Charleston, you know. And then they mentioned somebody named John, Papa John, who I never heard of before, you know. This turns out to be my great-great-grandfather. And they were really talking about him, saying that he may have had children wherever he went. And I said, well, why did he, you know, go so many places? They said they kept selling him because he was a rebellious slave. And so they would sell him from one, you know, one plantation to another. And I asked what happened to him. And they said that he was lynched, you know. And then they said, well, my mother and my sister telling me this, and her sister telling me this story. My mother says he was lynched. And then her sister says, yeah, and when they lynched him, they asked him if he wanted to say anything before they lynched him. And my mother started laughing, and she said, yeah. He said, hand me my mirror so I can see my hair, right, to make sure he looked good, you know. This was an amazing story, you know, and that they had this story all these years, you know. And apparently what happened is they lynched him. They knew the area. They grew up right down the road from where he was lynched. And they said that as children, little girls, they would be afraid to be down the road when sundown came because they thought the ghost of Papa John would come up to get them. Well, what happened is they lynched him and did a poor job. I didn't know you could do a poor job in a lynching. Did a poor job, apparently, and left him for dead. He wasn't dead. He made his way back to the black community, and some people turned him in, and they came back and finished the job, you know. And the choice there was, that was really a sacrifice, because the choice was, well, you know, either that or they come, you know, the Klan come, they come back, and no telling what happens then. You know, everybody begins to pay the price for that. So that was really a sacrifice, just to give an idea of what the raw terror was, you know, at that time. And so I had this story, you know, this, and that they knew since they were little girls, and these women are now in their 70s, you know. And what happened is the occasion of the family reunion allowed this story to surface. So when we got to the family reunion, it was my turn to talk, you know. And I told you I'd be interested in this rites of passage stuff, and there were all these young people in the family I'd never seen before, you know. I said, well, you know, I have a new hero. I discovered a hero on my way to the banquet. And I told this story about Papa John, you know. And several of the younger kids came up later and asked me all sorts of questions about it, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know where that's going, but somehow or another, not only is it a personal family story, but it has all these mythic possibilities to me.
Did you say to your mother, how come you never told me this?
I did,
before?
Yeah, I did. And they, it just somehow or another, it just never occurred to them, you know, that this story would be so valuable, you know. And even then, they weren't really telling it because they figured I needed to know. It just happened to surface. The other thing I recognize about aging and maturing and getting older is, you know, they say that every story has its time to be told. And what I realize now is dealing with my mother and her peers, you know, is you don't have to ask them almost for these stories. you're just around them, they start to surface. It's almost as if they want to give these stories up. They want to pass them on. I get kind of mystical about it. You know, there's something inside just saying that now it's time to tell this story. So it wasn't only that story since then. It's been many, many other stories that as a young boy, I just never heard, you know, but are very valuable.
My guest is poet Sekou Sundiata. His new music theater piece, Mystery of Love, opens tomorrow night at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Sekou Sundiata. You had a previous music theater poetry piece mm-hmm. called The Circle Unbroken is a Hard Bop.
Right.
And I believe that was set in the 60s or 70s and was about three radical African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a period that you were very politically active in yourself?
Oh, yeah, no question. That piece is set in the present, but reflects on that, on the late 60s and 1970s.
Mm-hmm. You have a character in The Circle Unbroken is a Hard Bop called Space.
Space.
And this is somebody who's kind of broken down during that period. Why don't you describe his character
a
little bit?
Well, one of the things that happened during that period of time when the movement was really decimated, the way the movement ended, decimated internally and externally, principally externally by, I think, the government through the COINTELPRO program, people were really traumatized. I mean, in much the same way that people were traumatized from being in battle, from being in combat, from being at war. So there was really post-movement trauma, a great deal of it, I think, that still exists to this day. And Space is that kind of person. He's been traumatized, and, yeah, he has broken down in a number of different ways, and he rants, you know. But there is a truth at the core of his rant. It's almost like when I hear people on the street ranting, I have two reactions. One is an aversion. I turn away. And the other thing is I kind of listen in at the same time, you know, because something is driving all of that. And Space is that kind of character.
Would you do a little bit of Space for us?
Yeah, as best as I can pull it together. Two times peace. From whence we come, that dark woman of a land only knows so well. How we tribalize our rest in the West, who could tell? Was once an exile knocked over across the bear, like a flatted fifth note of blue, you hear the terrible one we wear like a skin color. Mystery come down once again, crucify to suffer for us to see. Say X shall be your name till you raise it and praise it. The free you seek before you everywhere like air. In the beginning, 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 black and shining was our X. See, you got the circle of the mind, and you got the circle of the blood, and you got the pie and the square root, but that's not the bop. Now the circle of the blood, that's what we come here with. Tobacco Road, Kunta Kinte, Africa, Mambata, stuff like that. You can separate yourself in the circle of the blood, but you come out something that strains what the philosophy call alienation, because blood is the transportation system for demon and oxygen and goddesses to get to your brain. Never else and never less. You can separate yourself from the circle, but that's another bop. Now the circle of the mind, that's what we was after. Elevation of principle over pigmentation. Content of the character. Not what's on the head, but what's in the head approach to the predicament. Beginning with what's in the name. Ain't no rose, this I know. You mean to say a colored negroistic negro is still a negro, still a rose, a rose, a rose, a rose by any other name smells the same? I don't think so. Call me money, call me blood, call me B. Call me the 7-Eleven in the alphabet G. Griot on the spot. So then Nat Turner told me, do the tighten up. And Marilyn Monroe was butt naked on Charlie Parker's bedroom.
Wow.
Oh, God.
So what did you pattern that on when you were writing it?
So much. So much history, fact, and fiction.
But what, you know, I'm talking about the
style of it?
The style of
oh,
it,
oh, that's
yeah.
really a tribute to these saxophone players that I loved and I kind of grew up on. I guess mainly John Coltrane and Pharoah Sanders. You know, I did the piece sort of just dredging up from memory, but in full performance, there are a lot of honks and squeals and slurred vowels and syllables that really, I think of it as paying homage to those horn players, those soloists.
Can I get you to close with another poem?
Oh, another poem. There's a poem that we recorded on the first record we made called The Sound of the Memory of many living people, which I dedicated to a friend of mine, poet, wonderful poet by the name of June Jordan. So let me see. I never went to hear John Coltrane because I thought you had to belong to something. Sunlight, sidewalk, crack, crack, crack. They were like two waters, swishing, gurgling, two winds sighing through a wooden flute. Their eyes were closed. Fish smells, burnt hair, ashy faces, shiny hands, band-aids, ribbons. You can fly to the edge of the sea, and the fishermen will eat your wings with French fries and Coca-Cola on the side. Everything in the dream is the dreamer. The year the Mississippi River just sat like a hard promise, choking on vessels of commerce stuck on the whim of the hawk who sought no favor nor gave none, like a widow of winter. And the Boy Scouts found four crack-faced cattlemen bent over a cross in a Bible. She offered her eyes, searching across their habits, recoiling sharply, the gift was not free to give. He was thinking about the secret of life. This woman, who smelled like carnation milk, dropped to the floor when the senior choir sang hot cone grease, melted chicken neck sopranos reaching velvet claws to heaven. You could see where she was dark in the middle. She cried, oh yes, oh yes. Their eyes were closed. Last night, I had a dream with peaches, and I woke up stuck to myself. I am nobody. You wouldn't use that word if you knew what it meant. It ain't pretty. It's bloody. It overturns things. It overturns things. I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But when you smell the shoe polish on your breath, the sun goes down even, Stephen. Pow, 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 pow. This is the voice of reason. All that I see, I do not see. All that I know, I do not know. The eagle is the center of the universe, and I am but a speck in the spectrum, and changes for hands greater than my own. Pow, pow, pow. The first picture I saw of Charlie Parker was a melted bird on a naked branch with busted wings in Abyssinia Baptist Church. And if it was a secret, we couldn't even keep it. Swish.
Was there an occasion you wrote that for?
Oh. No, not a particular occasion. I was really actually working on some of the same things we were talking about at the time. I was trying to find these images and experiences that I thought were like deeply embedded in the consciousness. In that case, particularly of African American people. For example, there's a point, three things in the poem where it says, one voice says, I am nobody, and then the response is, you wouldn't use that word if you knew what it meant. It's bloody. It overturns things. It overturns things. That's really a paraphrasing of Malcolm X. People at the time used to say revolution, and he used to caution them. He'd say, you wouldn't use that word if you knew what it meant. And then Martin Luther King, who said, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But, you know, there are other things that are more important, you know. And then a revolutionary activist at the time by the name of H. Rapp Brown used to say that, you know, people won't move to change their condition until they smell the shoe polish on their breath, knowing how far things had gotten at that point. So there were all those kinds of references in the poem, and I was just trying to, you know, the sound of the memory of many living people, just trying to document those images.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Sekou Sundiata's new piece, The Mystery of Love, is receiving its world premiere this week at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a novelist turned politician returns to writing. We talk with Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa about his failed bid for the presidency and the attempts on his life. He left his country just a couple of days after he lost the election. Now he has a new memoir about his literary and political life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Some Change, Boss Skaggs' latest release. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A group of Haitian senators backed by the army has inaugurated a provisional president. Elderly Supreme Court Justice Emile Jonassant has taken an oath of office to replace toppled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He was democratically elected. The move lacks the support of most Haitian lawmakers and the international community. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the procedures used to replace Aristide seem invalid. The Senate votes this evening on a measure that would ban lawmakers from accepting gifts from lobbyists. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The gift ban bill would close the door that many critics say gives special interests special access to members of Congress. It bars lobbyists from buying lawmakers lunch or dinner and forbids them from giving any gifts to lawmakers. What's more, lawmakers would be forbidden to accept free travel to charity golf, ski, and tennis tournaments. Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota says the proposed ban will go a long way toward ending the public's mistrust of Congress. The House has passed less far-reaching legislation without the prohibition on free travel. Advocates of the stronger ban say they will have a fight on their hands in negotiations with the House should the Senate bill pass this evening, but they are optimistic about their chances for ending what one lawmaker calls the mother of all perks. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
A South African judge has sentenced to death six members of an extreme right-wing group, the AWB, for murdering four black people last year. The judge said he hopes the sentences will deter other crimes. The BBC's Colin Blaine reports from Johannesburg.
The six members of the neo-Nazi AWB killed four black people after setting up a roadblock outside Johannesburg on the way to the organization's stronghold of Ventersdorp. It was a particularly brutal racial attack. The men who'd been drinking lined up the occupants of two vehicles and shot them. One of the victims was a 13-year-old boy. Another had an ear cut off, seemingly as a trophy. South Africa has a moratorium on executions at present, and the new government hasn't set out its policy on the death penalty, although the ANC has said in the past that it's opposed to capital punishment. More than 30 other members of the AWB were arrested last month after a series of bomb attacks during the run-in to South Africa's elections.
Colin Blaine reporting. President Clinton is expected to select a Supreme Court nominee soon to succeed retiring Justice Harry Blackmun. The president's short list reportedly includes Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, Arkansas Judge Richard Arnold, and Boston Judge Stephen Breyer. The short list may also include Judges Jose Cabranes of Connecticut and Amalia Kearse of New York. The president says the search will end soon. On Wall Street, an increase in long-term interest rates drove stock prices lower today. The Dow lost 27 points to close at 3,629. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The city of Milwaukee says it will issue special water contaminant alerts for AIDS victims and others with weakened immune systems. Beth Graham of member station WUWM reports from Milwaukee.
Milwaukee is the first city in the nation to issue alerts to people with compromised immune systems when low levels of cryptosporidium are detected in its water supply. In April of last year, some 400,000 area residents contracted a gastrointestinal illness from the protozoa in the water. Most recovered within days or a few weeks. However, 88 people have died as a result. Those victims, by and large, were suffering from immune system impairments caused by AIDS or cancer radiation treatments when they contracted cryptosporidiosis that contributed to wasting and inability to eat or take medicine. City Health Commissioner Paul Nanis says that if an alert is issued, those with weakened immune systems will be advised to boil any tap water or use bottled water. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Graham in Milwaukee.
Japan's opposition Socialist Party has called for early elections to restore a stable government, but Minority Prime Minister Tsutomu Hata has rejected the call. The opposition Liberal Democratic Party has opened a campaign headquarters to prepare for early elections anyway. The Socialists walked out of Hata's quarrelsome coalition government last month. Hata is ruling with less than a majority in parliament. If the Socialists or the Liberal Democrats call a no-confidence vote in Hata, he could be toppled quickly. There are reports of a second Scud missile attack on northern Yemen today. Two missiles apparently landed in residential areas of Sana'a, the Yemeni capital. An earlier attack reportedly killed 25 people. There have been several Scuds fired at the city since civil war broke out last Thursday, but these are the first that have caused casualties. The wars between northern Yemeni forces who support the president, southern forces back the vice president. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist Mario Vargas Llosa was almost President Vargas Llosa. He ran for the president of his country, Peru, in 1990 and lost to Alberto Fujimori. Just a couple of days after the election, Vargas Llosa moved to England. There he wrote a memoir about his literary and political life. It's just been published in the U.S. It's called A Fish in the Water. Vargas Llosa is a major figure in Latin American literature. He emerged during what's been described as the Latin American boom of the 1960s. In the U.S., he is perhaps best known for his novel Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, which is adapted into the film Tune In Tomorrow, starring Keanu Reeves, Barbara Hershey, and Peter Falk. I asked Mario Vargas Llosa what made him decide to run for president.
Because in that particular moment, the situation in Peru was so catastrophic that it seemed not only that the very fragile democratic system that we had could collapse, but even that the country could disintegrate, you know, in chaos. We had hyperinflation, we had terrorism, the fall of the standards of living were dramatic, and there was this pessimism, so I felt, as many other Peruvians who until then had never participated in practical politics, pushed to intervene, you know, in the public debate about the options of change, and then in the campaign. But I did it more for moral reasons than for a political vocation or for appetite for power.
What were your encounters with the Shining Path like during the election?
Oh, encounters. Well, they tried to kill me twice. And they were ferocious, particularly in the last month during the period between the first and the second round of the election. More than 100 people who were working with me in grassroots organizations were assassinated by the Shining Path. And there were many, many attempts, you know, to kill people who were working very closely with me, and in two occasions they tried to kill me too.
How did they try to kill you?
Oh, they tried to bomb one plane when it was landing in a small airport in the Amazon region, and then they put a bomb in a neighboring house. Which fortunately was discovered before exploding.
When the Shining Path tried to bomb your plane, how was that prevented?
Oh, it was just by... It's an incredible story, you know. I tell this story in detail in Fish of the Water. A group of people from a small slum in Pucallpa, very close to the airport, discovered a group of strangers to the neighborhood hiding in the landing piste of the airport, exactly in the moment when my plane was landing there, and so they approached to see what were they doing, and they were received with shots and had to be taken to the hospital, and the terrorists escaped, but they abandoned there the bomb that they were using, which was we discovered when we get out of the plane. That was probably the most risky episode in the whole campaign.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mario Vargas Llosa. He's a novelist and also ran for president of Peru in 1990 and lost to Alberto Fujimori. Mario Vargas Llosa has written a memoir called A Fish in the Water. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Mario Vargas Llosa. He ran for president of Peru in 1990 and lost. We've talked a little bit about running for office. I want to deal with the other part of the memoir, the more personal part of your memoir. Your parents were divorced before you were born. They were separated, I should say, before you were born. And you basically thought your father was dead when you were growing up?
That's right. I was my first 9 years, I thought that my father was dead. And only when I was 10 years old, my mother revealed to me that he was alive and that they had been separated and that they now were reconciled and would be living together and that I would be living with my father. Yeah, that was probably the most important event in my life.
Was that good news for you?
Well, it was surprising news. It was something that I certainly didn't expect it. Very soon I discovered that it would be very, very difficult for me to adapt myself to the kind of personality that my father has. It was a very difficult relationship. Until then, I had lived with my mother and my mother's family, and I had been, a very spoiled child. And suddenly, I started to live with a man who was very rigorous, very strict. So I had to adjust myself to a kind of discipline and control that until then I didn't know. And it was a very, very difficult transition. And as I say in my book, I think this experience was essential for the development of a literary vocation in myself.
Why would an authoritarian father be essential to the development of your literary interests?
Because I think imagination, fantasy was a refuge, was a place where I could take refuge when I felt alone and abandoned and anguished and desperate. That was my revenge, you know. In that world of imagination, of fantasy, I could be happy, I could be free, I could really be my own master. Something that in the real life I wasn't. Huh?
Was your father authoritarian with your mother, and did your mother change when you both started living with your father?
Oh, my mother was completely dependent on my father. You know, he had a very strong personality. But my mother loved him, you know, and I think she resigned herself to the abuses and even violences that this relationship implicated for her, because there were compensations. You know, I think my father, in his way, also loved her a lot. But my case was quite different, because for me, my father was an stranger, and he never tried really to establish, you know, a loving relationship with me. And I didn't, and neither, you know.
One of the things you write about in your new memoir, A Fish in the Water, is your first marriage, which was in part the basis of your novel, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter. And this is the story of how you married your older aunt when you were 19, and I think she was in her early 30s. What was the family reaction when you fell in love?
Well, the family, of course, was extremely worried and unhappy with these barriers that they thought would be very destructive for me. But actually, it wasn't. We were married almost 8 years, and it was during those years that I became a writer. My first marriage was, in this sense, quite successful.
Was your family more upset about the age difference between you and your aunt, or about the fact that she was your aunt?
Well, she was not my aunt. She was the sister of one of my uncle's wife. So it was an aunt in political terms, but not in...
Not in blood.
Not in blood, now. No, they were worried, of course, because this age difference, and they, I think, were quite sensibly worried, because 12 years of difference, you know, is something that sooner or later would produce what actually it produced, you know, a very difficult kind of coexistence.
When you divorced, you later married a cousin of yours, who I believe you're still married to.
Yes, I am.
Was she a cousin by blood?
Yes. First cousin, yes.
Was there any taboo against that?
No, not at all. The family was quite happy with this marriage. And, well, it's been a very successful marriage, because we are been married more than 30 years now.
I want to talk more about literature with you. When you were growing up, you say that you really didn't read much Latin American literature. You mostly read American and European fiction.
That's all right.
You later read a lot and wrote about Latin American fiction, but why wasn't it interesting to you when you were younger?
Well, you know, at that time, I think my case was quite common among young writers and intellectuals in Latin America. The lack of communication between country to country in literary terms was enormous. We didn't know in Peru in the 50s what was published in neighboring countries like Chile or Ecuador. We were much better informed about the new North American writers, or French, or Italian, or English writers. We didn't know much, you know. So that's what I read. I read the Lost Generation writers, for example, and I read a lot of French writers. And it was only in Europe, you know, in the 60s, when I was living in France, that I discovered literally Latin American literature. And I discovered at the same time that many European and American readers were also discovering that Latin America had been producing very interesting poets and novelists, and it was something very enriching.
Last July, in an article in the New York Times, it was reported that you are now among Peru's most disliked figures. And the article said that Peruvians hated your memoir, which was published there before it was in the United States. Do you agree with that? Do you think of yourself as being among your country's most disliked figures now?
Well, that I... we need a plebiscite to decide that. But my book was not very popular, of course, when it was published, among the fans of the regime. Because since the 5th of April of 1992, when Mr. Fujimori produced this coup and destroyed the democratic system and closed the parliament and sent all the judges to their houses, I started to criticize, as I've been doing until now, the collapse of the Peruvian democracy because I think this is a tragedy, you know, for Peru. And this, as the coup was popular, particularly at the beginning, this made of me a very unpopular figure. So there were many, many criticisms of anything that I said and I wrote against the coup and against Fujimori. But things have been changing since, and now apparently the regime is much more unpopular than myself. So I'm not so unpopular now, apparently, in Peru.
So you think the regime's catching up to you?
Yes, I think so.
That's
my impression.
So do you think you'll ever move back?
I don't know. What I know is that I won't move back to politics. But to my country, yes. When things change, when things improve, certainly, yes.
Mario Vargas Llosa, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mario Vargas Llosa's new memoir is called A Fish in the Water. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have from Haiti?
Hi, Terry. Haiti has named a new president in defiance of the United States. The head of Haiti's Supreme Court is now the president, according to Haiti's military rulers. I will speak about Haiti with Sadako Ogata, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. William Drummond reports on political correctness in America as we continue our series on the cultural difficulties affecting our country. And I'll speak with an importer of South African wine who says, yes, the sanctions did hurt the South African wine industry. And now he's expecting big things for South African wines in this country. Also, a new book collects insults from one writer to another.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Singer-guitarist Boz Scaggs hasn't released an album in over 6 years and hasn't had a big hit since his 1976 album Silk Degrees. Now he has a new CD called Some Change, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it's really quite a pleasant surprise.
You got my letter, but you must not read your mail. You got my letter, baby, but you must not read your mail. Well, I'm a happy man if I can get to you, and I'm a sad man if I fail.
It is the fate of most pop stars to become frozen in time. They achieve success with a career-defining hit or series of hits, then do variations on those hits until their popularity fades. For Boz Scaggs, that period of success came in the mid-70s, when songs like Lowdown, Lido, and Dinah Flow made him the ultimate purveyor of blue-eyed soul. As if recognizing this achievement and its limitations, Scaggs pretty much dropped from sight in the 80s, choosing to become a restaurateur in San Francisco. The snap and vigor of Some Change, however, suggests that Scaggs is feeling a hunger to make good music again.
Some change comes down for the better. Some come round like the weather. You take that too. But like some change in your pocket, sometimes it seems to be too little too late.
guess it's time to break out a few pesos. Cause I'm getting to where I like the view. And if you're feeling lucky, you ain't just passing through. You might change some too.
Listening to Some Change, you're reminded that before his 70s success, Skaggs was a hardworking blues guitarist whose 1969 debut featured a scorching collaboration with Duane Allman on Loan Me a Dime. What makes Some Change sound like a fresh collection for the 90s is the way it strips away all the slick mannerisms that Skaggs picked up 20 years ago and replaces them with simple, raw emotions.
There was a howl that night, a howling like they'd never heard before. He cried so loud, oh granddad, almost hit the door. Said, I love this child much as anyone that she ever bore. But I thank the Lord we won't be having any more. Then the baby heard the sweetest sound he'd ever heard. In tones so beautiful he hung on every word. Take to the sky. It was on such a night he learned to fly like a bird.
It's unlikely that Boz Skaggs will again become as popular as he was with Silk Degrees unless he undergoes the same miracle that occurred with Bonnie Raitt and a young audience of millions comes to its senses in appreciation of his skills. But as an unexpectedly fine coda to an honorable career, Some Change glows with a warmth that proves that Boz Skaggs is no frozen pop star.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Boz Skaggs' new album, Some Change. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock and Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.